Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say he liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins.
Michael Trinkline has been nominated for 3 Emmys along with his co-creator, Steve Betcher. They produced Pioneers of Television for PBS. They also did Betty White, A Celebration. And Robin Williams remembered. But their latest film is Dick Van Dyke's 100th celebration. Michael, you live right here in Milwaukee.
I do. I live just south of Port Washington, and I grew up in Cedarburg.
So you are doing all of these Emmy-nominated shows, big shows about people like Betty White and certainly the pioneers of television, which was huge when that came out. You do that all right here.
Yeah, we do all our production in Wisconsin. Of course, we went to California or New York or wherever the celebrity lived through the interviews. And I've interviewed, 100 people over the years, from Jerry Seinfeld to Dick Van Dyke. We even go back to even the Milton Berle days. And I think part of it is that I think people in middle America really appreciate these stars more. I think on the coast, it's kind of a disposable celebrity thing, but we keep these people in our hearts as part of our family. And I think both Steve and I, my co-producer, Steve Betcher, we show up with a certain amount of respect and care and knowledge for these celebrities that they don't maybe get later in their career. So I remember when we one time interviewed The Price is Right host, Bob Barker, and we were, Steve said, Mike, we got to wear suits. So we wore suits, and he was like, he had all these, like, Entertainment Tonight and TMZ and all these shows that wanted to talk to him. Was it like his last week on the job? And he said, no, I'm talking to those boys in the suits. And so he spent time with us. And I think that's part of our approach to these things is to treat these people with the respect they deserve because they're very talented, whether they're on a famous show right now or not.
When you were growing up in Milwaukee, what were you watching on TV?
You know, it's funny because I did watch the Dick Van Dyke Show every afternoon. It was on every afternoon in Wisconsin, syndicated. So I think I got through all those episodes right after Gilligan's Island, before the Brady Bunch on Fridays. But Dick Van Dyke was a big part of my growing up, and I know a lot of those episodes by heart.
What was it about that show that drew you to that character?
You know, it's funny. It's different for everyone. Some people, Mary Tyler Moore is so sweet and pretty, and other people, it's, they just liked the whole storyline. For me, it was the idea of those scenes when they were in the office with Maury Amsterdam and Rosemary and Dick Van Dyke, and they were in the writing room, and they were throwing jokes back and forth, and he would tell a joke, and they would tell a joke, and then there was this kind of a joke. And as a kid, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, thinking, wow, people can actually write funny stuff for a living. That's really cool. And that's kind of what I do today. Not exactly the same, but I mean, it was really an inspiration, and I love those parts of the show as a kid. So, yeah, I was a big fan of the show and just love the writing room angle of it.
One thing about the show that I don't know if everybody's aware, but I think you bring this up in the 100th celebration, and that is the part of Rob Petrie wasn't created for Dick Van Dyke.
No, it's very funny. It was originally created by Carl Reiner to be a vehicle for himself, and he played the role that we now see Dick Van Dyke in. And I've seen that pilot, and there's some excerpts in the film. It's just kind of funny to see that everything kind of turned upside down with different actors playing, the Rosemary and Maury Amsterdam part and Carl Reiner playing the Dick Van Dyke part. And the show went to the producer, who was Sheldon Leonard, and he said, Carl, I love the show, but I don't love you. So they went looking for someone to fill that role, to play that part. And Dick Van Dyke had just come off Bye Bye Birdie on Broadway, and it was kind of a natural star. And they put him into the show and called it the Dick Van Dyke Show. But yeah, there is a version of that show with all different people playing different roles, right down to the Mary Tyler Moore role. It's very funny.
Who played her?
I don't remember her name.
So she wasn't memorable in the part, obviously. So one of the things that you did in the 100th celebration of Dick Van Dyke is you went back to Danville with him. Let's talk a little bit about him, because he grew up as a Midwest guy. He was born in Missouri, raised in Danville, Illinois, which really is kind of a, two-stoplight town?
Yeah, Danville is an interesting community. I've been there a lot lately, not just for this film, but my son is a postdoc researcher at the University of Illinois. So I've been to Danville a lot, and there's the Dick Van Dyke appliance store in Danville. It's kind of funny because they all love Dick Van Dyke. There's posters of him all over town. It's like they'd probably like to rename it Dick Van Dykeville. But, not only was Dick Van Dyke born there, of course, his brother grew up there, Jerry Van Dyke from the Coach TV series. Gene Hackman grew up there, and he was kind of in their little play group when they were little kids. In fact, I found out later that my wife is actually related to Gene Hackman. He's like her uncle, great uncle.
Wait, Gene Hackman and Dick Van Dyke used to play together as kids?
Well, Dick was a little older and Jerry was younger. And I think when Jerry was like 8, 9, 10, little Gene Hackman was like 3 or 4 running around and they kind of kick him out of the group because he was too little. So, yeah. And Donald O'Connor was there. I mean, there were a lot of interesting people all in this tiny little town of Danville. And part of the reason is, I think, and this comes out in the film where we go back to that high school and they had a very good performing arts program at that high school. And that's where Dick Van Dyke got his start. And I think that that town really wants to kind of cherish that memory by giving its nod to the arts and not just being about, you know, every town tries to have a great football team or something. But Danville, they really work to have the performing arts as part of their educational process. And Dick Van Dyke benefited from that.
And where did he go from there? He didn't even graduate, did he, from high school?
No, he wanted to join the Air Force and he wanted to fly jets and he was underweight. So he went to do performing radio and other kinds of performing for the armed services. Yeah.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He's not the kind of guy who would throw a tantrum or be angry. That's just not his personality. But at the end of the day, it wasn't what he had hoped that film would be.
Writer-producer Michael Trinkline talks about how Bye Bye Birdie was changed from the Broadway version to the movie.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with writer-producer Michael Trinkline. I'm your host, Libby Collins.
So how did he end up where he was? Because the Dick Van Dyke Show and even Bye Bye Birdie, he was in his, mid to late 30s. There was a long time from his late teens that he was trying to make it as a performer, but never quite hit it.
Libby, you have got it. This is the talking point of the day, because I think it gives hope to all people, because he was certainly talented. He did a touring show where he was like a mime. He did little comedy sketches. He was in a group with people who did comedy, kind of like, you know, that you might think of a Second City today. And he went nowhere. Finally, CBS picked him up and they said, this guy's got talent. We've got to find something for him. And they gave him the worst possible things. They gave him like a morning news show, which he wasn't really good at. They gave him a kid's show where he introduced cartoons. He wasn't really good at that. They gave him the CBS Morning News show with Walter Cronkite, who was just getting started in television.
Wait, Walter Cronkite? And who did the news? Van Dyke or Cronkite?
Well, Cronkite did the news, and then Cronkite got fired or moved or something, and then he complained that Dick Van Dyke actually fired him. And Dick Van Dyke's like, I'm a kid, I couldn't have fired you. That the anecdote's in the film, and we actually have some great images of them working together. So he couldn't find the right role. And CBS, they knew he was talented, but they couldn't find the right thing for him. And so you're right. It wasn't until his mid-30s that he actually got Bye Bye Birdie and then the Dick Van Dyke Show at that time.
Did you talk to him about how he got the part in Bye Bye Birdie? Because that was really his big break.
He would go to auditions all the time on Broadway, and he had some small things here and there. You could tell in an instant he was different. You know, that ottoman fall at the beginning of the Dick Van Dyke Show, I mean, that's the kind of thing he could do instantaneously. In fact, when we interviewed him, you know, he's in his 90s, and we're coming down the elevator, walking him back to his car, and someone says, oh, can I get a photo? He's like, not a photo. We're going to dance. And he's dancing with people, right? And he's good, I mean, obviously. So even back then, he really had this ability to immediately do moves and maneuvers that don't normal people can't do. And so, and of course, he also has this great voice. And he talked about, even in Danville, as this young Midwestern boy growing up, that he had this deep voice that immediately could project to the back of the room. He kind of talks about this in the film about his time in high school, and that immediately made him, you know, the guy who got all the parts in the high school plays, because he could project. So he has this voice, he has this fantastic physical comedy ability, and then he also can sing, right? And he also, you know, is just a nice person to be around. So all those things together kind of finally landed him the Bye Bye Birdie role.
He had a lot of stage presence as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's definitely got stage presence, and you could see that. We interviewed Carl Reiner, too. And I remember one of the questions I asked him was about some of these singing and dancing sections in the Dick Van Dyke Show. And what he would do is he would write a script. Instead of a 25-page script, it would be like a 20-page script. And then he would say, okay, after Act 3, Dick Van Dyke does 10 minutes. Okay, then we go back to the story. Because he could do that. Dick Van Dyke could just come up with a bit where he would dance or sing or do something. And there are all those, if you watch the show, there are all these episodes where they would start singing and dancing, you know, as part of the plot, but it would be what they would do.
So he's doing the Van Dyke Show, and they decided to make Bye Bye Birdie into a movie. Was he always intended to be in that role? Because so often, the Broadway actors don't make it into the film.
Well, that's a bonus of contention, and it's one of, I think, the regrets of his career is that they changed the film. In the Broadway play, he was a major role. In the film, he was more of a minor role, and they kind of changed. They added this Anne Margaret character, and Anne Margaret has her attractions, and so she got more time in the film, and Dick Van Dyke got less. And he's not the kind of guy who would throw a tantrum or be angry. That's just not his personality. But at the end of the day, it wasn't what he had hoped that film would be.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
You know how people do Wisconsin accents over the top? We'll go, that's not what we talk like. Well, they were doing a lot of that for him, yeah.
Writer-producer Michael Trinkline tells us why Dick Van Dyke's role in Mary Poppins was criticized.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Trinkline. I'm your host, Libby Collins.
So he's still on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Did that because he wanted it to end, or who made the decision to cancel that show?
There was this feeling at that time that in television, if you got five seasons done, that was enough episodes, it could go into syndication and the producers could make their money. And that's all they really needed was five seasons. And so I think they kind of felt like, well, and in fact, Dick Van Dyke said at one point, well, then we'd have to go to color and that would be a whole thing. And, you know, and it's just kind of funny how nowadays we don't think of television as kind of a launching pad, because all the people on that show thought, oh, this show's done well, now we can all do movies. And that's what you really want. Whereas nowadays it's different. You do a great TV show, you just keep doing more TV shows, right? You know, and movies are almost second class compared to TV sometimes. So I think it was a different time when you just wanted to get enough TV in to make your money and then you moved on to something bigger.
Plus he had Mary Poppins.
Right.
And that was a huge movie back then.
Right.
But he was criticized for something.
Yes, he was. Libby, you're getting to all the dirt. He had a voice coach who gave him an accent that he thought was the right accent, and no one on set told him to do anything different. And so when the film came out, he won accolades and awards for his singing and dancing, but people who were British of origin did not like his accent.
His Cockney accent.
I won't try to do it here, but let's just say it was a little bit over the top. You know how people do Wisconsin accents over the top, and we'll go, that's not what we talk like? Well, they were doing a lot of that for him, yeah.
But the interesting thing about that is it wasn't held against him because he was offered a huge role that was a British icon.
Right. The story goes he was offered the role of James Bond.
Did that really happen?
He says it did. I mean, I don't have printed documentary evidence, but it's not impossible if you think about that time, who they were putting in the role of James Bond. George Lazenby was in there at one point. I mean, you had
one movie only, yeah.
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, to have an American they thought might help the franchise. But yeah, he certainly could be suave and debonair, and he would have brought off kind of a fun angle to the role, but that did not work out. And in fact, his famous quote about that is, I would only do it if I didn't have to do an accent.
All right, so his film career did okay. I mean, he had some decent films. But he never really made it to John Wayne status.
Right. Well, you want to know why that is? I have a theory about this. And one of the things about Dick Van Dyke that people don't know, and we really try to kind of get to this in the film, is that he's a person of character. And he very intentionally turned down roles that he thought were too risque, that he thought would be R-rated. Now, there are some exceptions. He did drama, but he just didn't do things that he thought were in poor taste. One of his great dramas was a film called The Comic, where he played kind of a comedian, sort of a Buster Keaton type, who goes through life and becomes narcissistic and then eventually becomes, you know, living on his own, eating TV dinners. And he's won accolades for that, a very dramatic role. But he mostly stuck with the comedy and sort of the family-friendly type of thing, and that was intentional.
Dick Van Dyke, as much as he was beloved and still is, also had his demons.
He did. And our film, we really want to celebrate his 100th. So we want to talk about all the fun things. You want to see all the fun clips. We interviewed all of his friends. So Mary Tyler Moore is in the film, and Betty White, and Tim Conway, even Rosemary and Maury Amsterdam. We interviewed them before they passed. So we want to make a fun film. It is true. He battled alcoholism, and he's been very open about that. He went through a divorce that he says he felt guilt over. One thing I did ask him about was kind of funny, because when you watch the Dick Van Dyke Show in the 60s, they actually did commercials for cigarettes. And he smoked for a long time. And I asked him about that. And he said, yeah, I should not have done that. He and Mary tell him where there's a spot where they're both like smoking and going, you know, whatever, the cigarette is fantastic. And he's like, why did I do that? That was terrible. But he actually was a person of character and wanted his films and his work to reflect that.
You spent a lot of years putting this all together. Was the goal all along that you'd release it at a particular time, or did it just sort of keep creeping up as you were doing it, that he was getting close to his 100th birthday, and boy, this would be something to really celebrate.
Yeah, I mean, we started, 25 years ago, so we weren't quite thinking about his 100th at that time. But I think both Steve Betcher and I were looking to the future. So when we interviewed people who had worked with him, we made sure we chatted with them about him to make sure we got these interviews. So like we interviewed Rosemarie and Maury Amsterdam, before they passed, and got their take on this in a way that they hadn't been interviewed for a long time. So we had been kind of, it's in the back of your mind for a long time, planning, well, let's hope we can do this. Let's hope we have an opportunity for it. And we finally did have an opportunity, and we thought maybe his 90th, and then it just kind of, his 100th seemed perfect. So that's what we're doing.
And you spent time with him here in the last couple of years?
Yeah, we interviewed him a few years ago in depth. I chatted with him for a couple of hours, but more recently, we took him to Danville, his hometown, and we walked through the house where he grew up. And we went to the high school where he first performed. And we went to the radio station where he first got started. And we have some of those clips of his first, as a 17-year-old on the radio, talking and doing his first bits. And so we went with him and his wife, and the kids at the high school did all kinds of performances for him of some of his greatest hits. So they're all doing, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang songs and Mary Poppins songs. And he's just eating it up. And he's just, he goes through his house, and this is the room where, my brother Jerry and I would, do this. Or this is where his dad's name was Cookie. That was his nickname because he sold cookies. And he was a cut-up in Danville. And so the Van Dyke family was well-known, even if they had never gone to Hollywood. They would have been famous in Danville. So everybody had a story about, Dick Van Dyke or his brother or his dad. And so we kind of all put that together. And so Danville's a big part of the story and a lot of fun.
How sharp was he? I mean, approaching 100 years old, not everybody makes it. Did he act like he was close to 100 years old? Or, did you notice, boy, he's not the same guy he would have been 20 years ago? How sharp is he?
It's a question I can speak to because, right now I have two aging parents who are approaching 90 and they're doing very well. But I'm very cognizant of what should you look for, right? And I think physically, mentally, he's actually really sharp. He did a video just recently with Chris Martin, and that was, that kind of showcased what he could do. He's still doing, bits once in a while on YouTube, et cetera. Yeah, he's very sharp. Physically, he's also good, but, when you're 100, you're not good for 18 hours a day. You're good for 2 or 3 hours a day, and you get tired after a period of time. But I think for a person who's 100, literally 2 years ago, he's dancing. When they did Mary Poppins Returns a few years ago, he had to do a scene on top of a table, and he jumped up on the table at, his late 90s, right? So he's surprisingly good condition, and it's kind of an inspiration for everybody. And I think if you asked him why, what's his secret? That's obviously the next question. What makes him do so well at this advanced age? Obviously, genetics is part of it, but I think a big part of it is the fact that he just has a super positive outlook on life.
Has he seen the film?
Yes, he has. Uh-huh.
What do you think?
Oh, he liked it. He liked it a lot. I think the fact that we're making a film that kind of celebrates his life, and we're making a film that makes you walk out of the theater and feel good, right? I mean, that's the goal of it. And so I think that's his brand is our brand in the making of this film. We're not making a dark movie. We're not making a tell-all movie. We're making a movie that kind of celebrates a career, and that's a career that he's very proud of.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
They wanted to tell jokes, but they didn't want to offend any portion of America.
Writer-producer Michael Trinkline compares today's late-night host to the great Johnny Carson.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Welcome back to our conversation with writer-producer Michael Trinkline.
You and your partner Steve Betcher have done a lot of documentaries about legends in television.
Right.
What makes a legend?
I think more than anything, there's a certain amount of luck, but I think people think it's innate talent, and Dick Van Dyke is an example of someone who does have a lot of innate talent. But I guess from interviewing all these people over the years, it's really more about perseverance. It's more about people who are willing to give up something to attain something. And so a lot of people who are very, very famous often have parts of their lives where, they just had to not have that part of their life. I feel like Betty White never had any children, right? So we did a film on her, and she's a wonderful person, but she had to make that decision. I'm not going to have a family, and that's just it. And other people have made other sacrifices. So I think, if you think that people who are famous have it all, they often don't. They have something they worked for. I was so interesting interviewing Joan Rivers because we went to her house, and she's a $1 million house, and we went to the upstairs, and she had this room, and you know, it was just overlooked Central Park, and she had all this stuff. But you could tell, even at that time, she still carried this need to prove herself, you know, and just like, you know, it's so funny. I remember sitting in the room, and on one side, there's this cabinet, and it's all her jokes in a filing cabinet.
She really did have all her jokes.
Oh, I saw it. Yeah, yeah. It was right there, all in a filing cabinet. And yet, you know, when interviewing her, and I saw photos of her when she was, you know, in her 20s. I thought she was very pretty, actually. And she hated how she looked, right? She thought she was ugly. And that was her whole shtick, was how ugly she was, right? And she wouldn't hear anything other than the fact that she was ugly. And I think she kind of had this thing on her shoulders her whole life where she just wanted to prove herself. And so I think, you know, you just because you're famous and you have a lot of money and you have people adoring you doesn't necessarily mean you're happier. And there are people who are – a lot of people are certainly really nice people and have great lives. And Dick Van Dyke, I think, is an example of that. But not everybody is. I think that if you get to that point, you have to give up something. And, you know, it's different for everyone.
Yeah, you're known, of course, for Pioneers of Television and the Betty White movie, you said,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Robin Williams, right. Dick Van Dyke. Are there any other legends you're working on right now?
Yeah, one or two I can tell you off camera. I can't really talk about on camera, but we actually did a film on a Milwaukee legend on Howard Fuller, actually, which is coming out in February on PBS, because the whole Milwaukee school choice movement and school movement led the nation in a lot of ways. So we've spent a lot of time the last 5 years working on that project. So it's a little bit different. It's not a, you know, not the usual Hollywood celebrity type, but that'll be on PBS stations in February.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Pioneers of Television when mm-hmm. you did that, and especially the one episode about Johnny, Jack, Steve, and Merv.
Oh.
The icons of late night television.
Right.
When you look back at them and you see the people who are on late night TV these days,
right.
Is there a comparison?
Well, no. And I think that the one comment I would make, and I'm not the first person to say this, it's pretty obvious, but I remember we interviewed Dick Cavett. And he was really interesting because I found in the files in the National Archives the part where Richard Nixon said, "Let's get Cavett. We got to get rid of this guy." And he had always wondered if that existed. And I found it. And
You actually found it?
Oh, I found it. And I played it for him. And he said he couldn't believe it. He was like, "This is the greatest day ever." He kept calling me Trinkline. He didn't know my first name. But he was very excited about it. And you know, he called me for weeks after that just wanting to talk about it. He was so excited that he was important enough to have been an enemy of Nixon. But to your question, I think all those guys had one thing that's different from, I think, our modern late night hosts. And that is they really did not – they wanted to tell jokes, but they didn't want to offend any portion of America. So they were very careful about, you know, they all told jokes about, if you go back and look at the tapes, you know, even Johnny Carson, you know, he would tell jokes about the Kennedys, but they would also tell jokes about Nixon. And they were never jokes about their politics. It was more about, you know, Kennedy being kind of a womanizer maybe, or those kind of jokes, or, you know, Bill Clinton being, you know, overweight, those kind of jokes. It wasn't really, they were sort of generic jokes, and they weren't really, they were always even. They were kind of on both sides, whoever was in power.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
He talked about how much respect he had for Johnny Carson and couldn't really replace him, but he did his own thing.
Three-time Emmy-nominated writer-producer Michael Trinkline tells us whether or not he thinks any current TV hosts have a potential to become a legend.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Libby Collins. We're talking with three-time Emmy-nominated writer-producer Michael Trinkline.
The interesting thing is there were two bridges, I think, between the people like Carson and Parr and Allen and who we have today, Kimmel, Colbert, right. Whatever. And that was Jay Leno and David Letterman.
Right.
Would you classify either of those individuals as future legends?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. In their own way, in their own time. Yeah. We interviewed Jay Leno, and he talked about, you know, how he felt and how he fell in that pantheon of people and how much respect he had for Johnny Carson and couldn't really replace him. And but he did his own thing. And, you know, we also actually interviewed Steve Allen, which was interesting because he really – if you look at the Steve Allen show – you understand everything better because you see where David Letterman comes from, right? I mean, you see where some of the even the modern guys come from. He's doing bits that are kind of coming back today, where Carson was more about talking and Jack Parr was more about lecturing people, but you know, it was more intellectual. But it was Steve Allen who was doing the stuff that we later saw and other guys do.
Now that we don't have the networks like we did. You know, you're talking about the greats that, what, we had three networks at the time. Mm-hmm. Now there are so many. There's so much television. You can't even keep it straight. Are the glory days of television behind us?
Oh, I think they're in front of us. I think they're right now. I think we live in the glory days of television because there's so much more money being spent on it, I think, to the point where it can be ridiculous. I mean, you see some of these shows, you know, like The Crown is a good example, or I was just watching Vince Gilligan's new show, Pluribus, I think it's pronounced. And they spend so much money just to kind of show off how much money they're spending, right? And I think but there are a lot of really high-quality shows out there. And one thing about, you know, we all remember Johnny Carson, for example, because he was part of our youth. But Johnny – in fact, we interviewed Ed McMahon, and I remember asking him about this. And he said, look, Johnny told me, we got to do this every night. We can't overextend ourselves, right? So we're not going to, like, do a sketch every night. We're not going to do, you know, a table bit. We'll do one table bit, but we're not going to overdo it, right? If you look at, like, the modern shows, Kimmel and Colbert, for example, I mean, they
or
have—
Fallon. Fallon does skits constantly.
Right, exactly. All of them do. And they have huge staffs, and they're constantly coming up with all these bits and fantastically produced shows, but it costs a lot of money. And that's a real problem because Carson's whole thing was he could get a big audience without spending a lot of money. He had a cardboard set and Ed McMahon, and they got an audience without all the writers.
But was that because he just had more innate talent?
I think so. I think he definitely knew how to interview people in a way that is a lost art in a lot of ways. Sure, that's true. Yeah.
How have the viewers changed in those years?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that viewers are maybe more looking for something that I want someone to tell the jokes that I like instead of just tell the generic jokes, right? We're all, that's like anything else in life. We're a little bit siloed probably.
Before I let you go, Mike, I have to ask you this question because right now everybody's talking about this attempted hostile takeover of Warner Brothers by either Netflix or Paramount. As a producer, how do you feel about that?
Well, I prefer to have as many different companies out there as possible and fewer mergers. I mean, we have a show on Peacock right now about Gary Coleman. Our show on Betty White was on Netflix, and then it was also on Peacock because everybody wanted her at the time that she passed. So, you know, if you're a producer, you want to be able to shop your wares to as many places as possible. So it's nice to see as many different, you know, you hate to see a big conglomerate. You know, when I grew up, when you grew up, there were just three networks, and it was really hard for independent producer to really work in that world. So as there are more and more outlets, that's good if you're a producer.
So as a producer, is it easier to sell things now or more difficult?
In some ways it's more difficult because the budgets are so much higher, then there's so much risk involved that they don't want to take as many risks as maybe they used to.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
She said, I shouldn't really tell you. I said, it's okay. You can tell me. She said, I shouldn't tell you. She finally told us.
Writer-producer Michael Trinkline reveals a couple of off-the-record celebrity confessions.
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Welcome back to our conversation with writer-producer Michael Trinkline.
Mike, one other thing you've done is you've written some books. And this one fascinates me. And it's called Lost States, where you took a look at some statehood proposals that never made it. How did you find this topic?
Oh, well, now we're going to a new category. Okay, so ever since I was a kid, and this is actually kind of a Wisconsin story. I remember seeing in Time magazine an article about the Upper Peninsula wanting to create its own state, the state of Superior. And I thought, as a kid, I'm like, you can do that? And then I learned, oh, you can do that. And we've done that a lot as Americans. We've constantly been making – it's only in our lifetimes that we haven't been making new states. But, I mean, up until, you know, 1960, it was like a regular event, right? You'd get some land and you'd divide it up into a state or you'd – you know, it was a common thing. And so I was just fascinated by the idea that the map was malleable. And it basically it comes down to this, and it's kind of somewhat relevant to today's situation. And that is that people in one part of a state feel they're not being properly cared for, so they threaten to secede. And then the people in the other part of the state say, all right, we'll give you what you want. And it's a way to solve problems without actually having a war or having a fight or having violence. You know, we have a lot of violence in our world now. This was a way the founders actually were very clever, because you can make a new state. I mean, if Superior wanted to be a state, if Upper Peninsula wanted to be a state, all they'd have to do is get Wisconsin to agree and the Congress to agree, and you'd have a new state called Superior. It's not hard. And it's been done a lot. You know, we've split states up, West Virginia and Virginia, or Maine was once a part of Massachusetts. We've done all kinds of chops. And I lived in Idaho for many years, and no one in Idaho thinks Idaho should be a state. It is the stupidest drawn state in the entire country. I mean, it makes no sense. And it should be, you know, changed and conglomerated. And there's always movements to combine and move. And it's just part of what makes us Americans, that we're not really going to settle for what's already there. We're going to find a better way to do it. And Americans have been pushing for that. And that's kind of what the book was about, all these efforts to create states, new states in our 50.
And what were some of the names of those states that never made it?
Yeah, there's one. I mean, the famous one is Transylvania, which had nothing to do with, you know, the bad movies, but had to do with the fact that trans meaning across and Sylvania meaning a lovely place. And that would have been kind of where Kentucky is. It would have been actually called Transylvania. In fact, there's a Transylvania State University there. So the name kind of hangs on. There was a Texlahoma idea of kind of part of Oklahoma and part of Texas forming its own state. I mean, they're all kind of funny names. That was a fun project to kind of collect all these, because no one had actually collected all these proposals. And I had a little file all when I'm like 9 years old up until I'm 49 years old. And I'm like, I should make this a book. So that's where it came from.
Well, between your books and your television projects, you seem to have acquired just a lot of things through your life. Is it an ongoing project for you to put these books and these documentaries together? I mean, do you have a beginning and an end?
Well, I think any creative person, they just want to create, right? So, like, I was drawing comic strips last winter, everyone likes to, and I'm sure you're the same way. I'm sure you have things that you like to do that maybe aren't radio, but they're creative, right? I mean, I think that's the definition of kind of a creative person. And a lot of bringing it back to a film like Dick Van Dyke, what's funny is that he is actually kind of an expert in computer graphics. He got a computer when he was in his late 80s, and he learned to program it, and he did computer graphics in the very early days of computer graphics. And because he's just like, he's got to create something, and if you don't have a show going right now, well, I'm going to work on the computer and make something. And I think that's pretty common. You see a lot of, you know, celebrities who paint, or they do all kinds of different things.
And is that the secret to staying alive till 100 years old?
I think so. Yeah, I think people who retire and think they're just going to like sit around, or, you know, they're going to just not work and that's all they're going to do, are going to be unhappy. But I think people who have been creating all their life, they find new avenues of creating new things, and it's so fun. And now, you know, a lot of people would say, well, the AI is ruining all that. And I don't know. I think it just gives you more ways you can be creative, just more options and more outlets. So I think that's true of a lot of celebrities. They generally, not that I'm putting myself in that category, but I mean, they generally like to because if you're an actor, you're not acting 24/7. You know, in fact, you're acting, you know, 3 months and then you're off for a year, you know, kind of, unless you're a really big actor. So they always find ways to do things. They're writing a book, or they're working on a screenplay, or they're trying to, you know, do all kinds of different projects. They do jewelry. It's just amazing when you go to someone's house, all the different things that you'll see that they do. Like, we went to, my favorite example was from Star Trek. Spock. Spock's name was
Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy, yes. We went to Leonard Nimoy's house and to interview him for Pioneers of Television. And his hobby was photography. And all throughout his house were these huge photos, like 10 foot high by 8 foot high photos. They were black and white photos, and they were, it's a family show, I know, but they were plus sized naked women. That's what he liked to photograph. They were all over his house.
Spock?
Yeah.
I'll never watch Star Trek the same way again.
I know. Well, tasteful. I'm not saying it was anything inappropriate. It was all very, you know, artistically and tastefully done. But you know, he had his own photo studio. In fact, we filmed him in his photo studio where he did his own print work and everything. He loved doing it.
With all the celebrities you've talked to through the years, is there ever something that they said to you, I'm going to tell you this, but you can't tell anybody?
Yeah, there was one. Well, I would never put something on the air that they told us not to tell. But I remember, I do remember talking to Barbara Eden from I Dream of Jeannie, and her first job was on I Love Lucy. And she had a kind of a role on that show, a one episode role. And I said, how was Desi Arnaz? And she said, oh, I shouldn't really tell you. And I said, it's okay. You can tell me. She said, I shouldn't tell you. She finally told us. But he just chased her constantly. He had a reputation. And Barbara Eden was a very lovely young woman, always still is. And they had to literally lock Barbara Eden in a room until her takes so that Desi Arnaz wouldn't get handsy with her.
You have all the secrets of television. There's no doubt about
it. That's very funny.
Michael Trinkline, again, this weekend. Dick Van Dyke, 100th celebration. It's only in theaters, just in time for Dick Van Dyke's 100th birthday, this Saturday the 13th and also Sunday the 14th.
Yeah, and it's a fun thing to do with your family. I mean, I think it's great to, you know, take your grandma out, take your aunt out, take your, even your kids can go, even kids would enjoy it. It's a fun event. It's a party, and that's what we want people to think of. It's not just a recitation of Dick Van Dyke's life, but it's a celebration of 100 years.
Thank you, Michael Trinkline.
Thank you.
We've been talking with three-time Emmy-nominated writer-producer Michael Trinkline. He's co-created a number of documentaries, including Dick Van Dyke's 100th Celebration, another one called Betty White, A Celebration, and he's also one of the people behind PBS's Pioneers of Television. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Michael, go to WTMJ.com, where you'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.